Welcome, Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Pat, I'm excited that we have Chris Cluey with us today. I love people who are passionate and speak up about their beliefs.
I know you do. That's why you came up with this here little podcast.
Yes, indeed.
And then after we talked to Chris, which, by the way, we taped this with Chris about 10 days ago. After we talked to Chris, we're going to tell you some more about the background story on the Sacred Legions. So hang around and you can get to know Max a little better.
And you'll get to know Pat a little bit better.
Yeah. So now let's go back to our interview with Chris Cluey.
Our guest today is Chris Cluey. I'm really excited. This was an interesting thing for me that I was literally chatting with Pat about how exciting it would be to bring you onto the podcast as one of our secular saints. And lo and behold, we reached out and we were able to make it happen. And I'm incredibly excited by it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate you, you know, taking the time to have me on your show.
Yeah, well, thank you for being with us. Real quickly, a secular saint is a phrase that was coined by Kurt Vonnegut, where people live decently in an indecent time. And the first time I ever met you, Chris, was because you were living decently in a what we thought then was an indecent time.
Right. Oh, for the golden days of our youth.
Yeah. Right. And it was right after my beautiful Sparkle Ponies.
Oh, thank you for buying the book and reading it. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I got it from you. You know what? I got it that day that you were in Carlisle all those years ago, and I never got you to sign it.
Oh.
I got all my notes in it, but I don't have you in it. You know, it was back in the day when the only people who were really mouthing off and being cruel were sort of local fidgety pop politicians who were, I think it was a dude from Maryland. Mm-hmm. Maryland legislature or House of Delegates that was picking on people who wanted to get married just because they weren't heterosexual. And you came to their defense in a very colorful letter.
Yeah, say, I would maybe term it like blisteringly obscene.
So was that the beginning of the book, Beautifully Unique Sparkle Ponies? Was that letter the impetus to write the book that followed, or did you always want to write a book?
Yeah, no, that was the impetus to write the book because I'd also been doing a regular column for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, kind of like to both do like funny opinion stuff based on football, but also to try to help educate people on what the same-sex marriage amendment was about. Because Minnesota was trying to ban same-sex marriage by putting a state amendment in. I was like, that's not okay. When a group, Minnesotans for Marriage Equality, approached me and said, hey, can you help out with this? I was like, yeah, for sure. Like, I'd love to help out with this. So anyway, so after the letter to Delegate Burns went viral, I started getting agents and literary publishers approaching me like, hey, you should write a book. And after about the fifth or sixth one, I was like, well, these are the people in charge of books. I should probably write a book at this point. So
just for a quick background for anyone who doesn't know who Chris Cluey is, which is crazy, but you were playing for the Minnesota Vikings then, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. I played for the Vikings for 8 years as the punter from 2005 to 2012.
Yeah. And I looked up your stats. You kicked, is it 27,000 yards?
Yeah, it's so for punting, it's total yardage isn't really a huge deal or like a great metric to measure by. More, it's like what is your gross average and net average? Gross average is basically how far the ball goes past the line of scrimmage before it is stopped or where it's caught. And then net average is the distance the ball is returned minus, you know, the amount that it went. So those two things can tell you a bit about how good someone is. The problem is the NFL doesn't keep track of the stats that really matter, which is also where the ball was caught on the field and how long in the air it was, because how long in the air the ball lasts gives your coverage team time to get down the field. So you can hit like a 60-yard line drive that's only in the air for 3.5 seconds, and it'll look good on paper because that's like a 60-yard gross, but you really screwed your coverage team because you didn't give them time to get down the field. Whereas someone who hits like a 44-yard punt that has like 5.1 seconds of hang time, that's going to be a fair catch every time because there's no way the returner is going to be able to return it because your coverage guys will be on top of him as he's catching the ball.
Now, I do not know anything really. I mean, it would be illegal for me to discuss football, I think, but I do have one more quick question on football before we get to the tackle you were
sure
part of last week. So does that mean you have to kick it higher up so that it's more of a parabola going up, so it'll stay in the air longer?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So that's actually the art of punting, is figuring out the best relationship between distance versus hang time. And then you also have to add direction in there as well, because a returner catching the ball in the middle of the field has a lot of field to work with, right? Whereas if you can force him to catch it over by the sideline, well, now he's pinned in on one side. It becomes a lot easier for your coverage guys to cover him. So basically the numbers you want to look for are, at the high school level, if you can hit a 45-yard punt with about 4.5 seconds of hang time, you'll probably get a scholarship to whatever college you want to go to. In college, wow, if you can hit like a 47, 48-yard punt with about 4.8 seconds of hang time, you'll have a shot at the NFL. And then the guys who hit, 48, 50 yards with like 5 seconds of hang time, that's where I was. Those are the guys who are going to stay in the NFL for quite a while and, do well. And I set most of the Vikings team records for punting when I was with the team. Unfortunately, I didn't get to kick the ball as far as I wanted to kick it because our coverage teams weren't very good. So my special teams coaches would ask me to sacrifice distance to get more hang time. Which I did because I wanted the team to win. But yeah, if it was up to me, I would have been hitting them like 60 yards, 5.1 seconds, right down the middle of the field.
That's part of being a team though, right? So that's cool that you had potential that you didn't actually even achieve other people on the team could have the potential to win.
Yeah, exactly. And it'd be funny too, because me and our kicker, Ryan Longwell, when we were practicing during the week, I'd just be bombing the balls down the field, just kind of I can do it and I enjoy doing it because I loved kicking the ball really hard. I'm just like, well, that's going to be a negative on my grading score if I do that in the game. And we're laughing because I'm just crushing the ball down the field.
So did your stance on gay marriage cost you your job?
It is my belief that it did, because like I said, I set most of the Vikings punting records. My stats were pretty much the same as they'd been my entire career. And the only thing that changed was I started speaking up about LGBTQ rights. Again, I can't point to any specific, here's where the, email or text exchange happened, but it became clear to me that if I was going to speak out on this issue, then I would no longer be playing in the NFL. You saw the same thing happen several years later with Colin Kaepernick, right? I'm not going to say that Colin Kaepernick was the best quarterback in the NFL, but Colin Kaepernick was a good enough quarterback that he should have still been playing in the NFL. And it was very obvious that the teams were not letting him play, not because of his athletic ability, but because he took a stance on what was an unpopular issue, which was police brutality.
Your whole life's kind of been, I'm not going to have my potential because I'm going to care about the team.
Right.
Because you're not gay, but there are gay people on your team. They're in the world. They're in the society you're part of. And in order to stick up for the people you care about, you lost something that was important to you.
Yeah. Well, so for me, the other thing that's really important is that at the end of the day, we're all human beings, right? Football is a fun job, but it's just a job. I have to go live in the society that I am a part of. And I want that society to be a welcoming one and an including one, because I want to be able to do what I want to do. And the only way that works is if everyone else is free to live their own lives. So when someone is being oppressed, I'm protecting myself by speaking out for them, because if the powers that be eventually come for me, I want someone speaking out for me. So I've got to do it when it's my turn to speak.
We have you here, obviously, at the moment because of the recent event with your city council. What prompted that action on your part?
So that one was prompted by the fact that our city council has been messing with the library for the last 2.5 years now. And this isn't the first city council meeting I've been to. It's just the first one I've been arrested at. So it all started back, like I said, I think about 2.5 years ago, one of our council members, Gracie Vandermark, she wanted to ban a bunch of books in the children's section, and all the books were LGBTQ books. And so the community got really upset, was like, you can't ban books from a library. You cannot do that as Americans. And so then she came back with, okay, well, we're going to establish a, 21 or 23 person panel that'll review all the content in the library, and any inappropriate content, will go into its own special room. And everyone was like, you're just talking about banning books again. you're trying to put a different name on it, but you want to ban books. And so it was at that point, a local group called Protect HB formed for the sole purpose of protecting the library. And so they started up a petition. Petition gathered, I think it was 15 or 16,000 signatures, well over what it needs to be brought to a ballot measure. Funnily enough, that petition and another petition I'll get to in a second were also on the agenda at the meeting I got arrested at. City Council is doing everything possible they can to ignore those petitions because they don't want to listen to their community. But yeah, so that was the second thing they did, was try to establish this panel. The third thing they did was, after the uproar about the panel, they said, oh, we're going to privatize the library. And people were like, wait, what? Like, you can't do that. That's like, stop messing with the library. So we started another petition that got, you know, massive amount of signatures. Again, I think like 15 or 16,000. And that petition would have made it so any attempts to privatize the library would have to be brought to a public vote first. Like, the council couldn't just decide to do that. It would have to be a public vote. And so, again, they're trying to ignore that petition as well. And then the fourth thing was this plaque, which, you know, just purely from a graphic design perspective, is ugly as hell. Like, it does not look good. it's not constructed well, and it's moderately offensive to the eyes, even at just a quick glance. Like, it doesn't look like something that should be on the front of the public library. Now let's get to the actual substantive issue of what's on the plaque. The original idea of the plaque was there was a MAGA acrostic in the center in the largest font on the plaque. And it said, magical, alluring, galvanizing, adventurous. And I don't know about you, but I don't really want to think alluring when I think of my library.
And pretty nonsensical words anyway, when you right. Put them together. It's not like any kind of mnemonic or anything like that. So no. That was strange. And I find it interesting, too. I live in Fishers, Indiana. And we had a similar thing with our library. People that were like, we're going to take every title out of the young adult section that mm-hmm. has anything related to anything LGBTQIA, whatever, plus, mm-hmm. we're going to take it out. And ultimately, it was John Green, who happens to live in Indianapolis, that got word that one of his books was going to be on the list. And he brought out a big outrage. And that just mm-hmm. flooded the next library board meeting. So, yeah, it isn't exactly an anomaly, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. And I think it speaks to something essentially American when we look at an attempt to censor books and we say, no, that's not who we are. Like, that's not what this country stands for. You know, we stand for the freedom of expression. Like, it's literally the First Amendment. Like, you have the freedom of speech. And especially for a community library, a public library, there shouldn't be any political messaging on it. Like, it's supposed to be an inclusive, welcoming place where anyone can come check out a book, read what they want, and it's there for the community. It's not there for political messages.
I think you've made an excellent point. I mean, I don't know how many words begin with the letter A. I'm going to guess 50,000. Mm-hmm. And they picked alluring?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is just a creepy word for a library, right?
Yeah. But if you know what words mean, you would never pick the word alluring.
Yeah, absolutely not. You know, I'm a journalist, and I just did a story on the fact that DEI, the new, mm-hmm. as the head of the National Coalition for the Homeless says, DEI is the new word for the N-word. It's just... Mm-hmm.
It's racist.
The new DEI firings that I reported on 2 weeks ago were anyone with prior experience as a homeless person. Mm. And the head of the Pennsylvania Civil Rights Organization said, you know, eventually it's anyone with prior experience with cancer. Mm. Anyone with prior experience who can give what you spoke about greatly in your book, which is empathy mm-hmm. to the surrounding community, has to be eliminated, because if we have empathy, we're not going to be banning books at all, right?
Right.
So it's this overarching desire for controlling all manner of thought.
Mm-hmm. And that's another reason why, like, I wanted to do the protest that I did, because Huntington Beach is kind of a microcosm of what's happening in the nation as a whole. Right. We have this 7-person MAGA city council that have made it very clear by their actions. They do not care about Huntington Beach as a community. They only care about what political power they can amass and how they can use it to move up further in Trump's orbit. And what we're seeing at the national level is the exact same thing. We have a government and an administration that does not care about America as a community. It does not care about what's best for America. It cares about what's best for themselves. And ultimately, it cares about what's best for Donald Trump. because he's the one in charge. And if you know anything at all about Donald Trump, you know he is never going to stick his neck out for someone else. And he will never protect someone else. And if you make a mistake, he is going to get rid of you as quickly as possible and probably make fun of you on the way out, no matter how long you've served him.
You know what's confounding about it is they've tricked people into believing that this absolutely selfish, narcissist, sociopath is doing all these selfish things for you.
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, oh, he's got my back. Where does that even come from?
So I'll tell you exactly where it comes from. It comes from Fox News. It comes from Newsmax. It comes from OANN. And it comes from Facebook. And it comes to a lesser extent from YouTube. One of the great things about our society is we are a very interconnected society in that we have the internet, right? Like we can share information very, very quickly. One of the horrible things about our society is that propaganda can be shared just as quickly. And those stations and those platforms are propaganda platforms. And we have to start calling them that because that's what they are. I mean, Goebbels would have been ecstatic if he'd had access to Facebook. Like he would have been like, what is this amazing thing I can use to warp people's minds? As a country, we have to figure out how to stop the propaganda attacks on the vulnerable members of our communities. Because a lot of these people, right, like they don't have access to a lot of stuff. Like they might live in a poor rural area. They might not have great education facilities nearby. Like they might not have a lot of food options nearby. And if the only choice for information is Fox News, well, then they're going to watch Fox News. And then they're going to believe it because that's all they see. So like we really need to reckon with the fact that like we have propaganda networks in our country and we're just allowing them to infect people's minds.
That's a really fine line, though. How do you walk that line between right. not allowing them to infect people's minds and having a First Amendment?
Yeah, that I wish I had the answer.
You know, in Germany, which thankfully, luckily, just recently rejected everything Musk and the other people were trying to stuff down their throats. But, you know, you can't buy Mein Kampf in Germany. You can't display a swastika in Germany. There is no First Amendment. And I don't think, I mean, I happen to love being in Germany, but it's not like you don't have freedom to express yourself. You just don't have freedom to shout fire in a crowded movie house, right?
So if it was up to me, what I would do is basically you have the freedom to speak unless your speech calls for the erasure of another human being. And I believe all of those networks meet that criteria because they've been consistently trying to erase trans people. In the past, they've tried to erase the LGBTQ community as a whole, and they've shown no signs of changing. So if your speech is denying the humanity of another person, then I'm sorry, we already had the debate on genocide. The Nazis lost. We don't do that as human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other night when you went to speak before the city council, and probably everybody's seen this video now, it's everywhere, where you said, basically, now I'm going to use one of the oldest forms of protest and I'm going to sit down. Right.
I'm going to engage in the time-honored American tradition of peaceful civil disobedience.
Right. And sit in front of the assembled leaders, for want of a better term, and just sit there. That's what you wanted to do, was sit there. But you didn't get a chance to sit there. It was unbelievable. I mean, before you sat down, you were, and I can only imagine that these guys have been dreaming of tackling an NFL football player right. their entire lives. Right? Yep. You gave them the one chance they would never have had otherwise.
They were pretty stoked to get called into action.
I mean, they attacked you before you sat down.
So a couple things I want to point out. The first one is that like our police department is actually a pretty good police department. Like I have no complaints how they treated me. I complied. They told me, hey, you know, here's what we're going to do. You know, no accidental running into door frames, like, you know, no stepping on someone's hand as you're picking them up. Like we have a good police department. But part of that is because some Democratic members of our previous city council spent the time to install like training modules. Because back when the George Floyd protests, the BLM movements were going on, like we had some really big protests happening in Huntington Beach. And so they trained the police department. right? Like on how do you deal with protesters appropriately, right? Like how do you treat people appropriately as a police officer? They did a great job. The other thing I want people to understand is when you're in a government that is sliding towards fascism, you want the police on your side. Like you want them to see you as human beings, and you want them to understand that we live in the same community together, and it's your community too. Because if the military gets sent in, you want the police to have your back because they are your local people. Like they are the people who are supposed to protect and serve you. Now, that being said, I think the reason why they're on me so quick is because our city council expects someone to do something because they know what they're doing is unpopular. I don't know how much you can make out from the video, but the architecture itself of the council meeting chambers has been set up to become more hostile. Before, the podium that people speak at was over off to the left, and you were addressing like kind of half facing city council, half facing the seats where everyone sits in. So it was a much more like welcoming, just general feel. They didn't have big barriers either. You see the kind of like stretch out barrier things. They didn't have those. It was more just a way to form the line for people coming in from behind. You know, you get up to the podium, you say what you say, and then you walk back to your seat. Our current setup is very antagonistic. It's clearly set up to be like a holding pen. And then there's like, okay, the city council on the other side. And half the time, they're not even looking at you. Like they're just daydreaming about whatever, looking down at their phones. And it's very clear they don't want to hear what the community has to say. But yeah, it's... Our city council expects violence to happen because they know that what they're doing is going to upset community members, and they know that they're not popular with what they're trying to do.
So what happened afterwards? They knocked you down? Because the video just stops there.
Yeah, so you can find the full video on Instagram at ProtectHB, because they were filming as well, and they have the full unedited, uncut, like it shows everything. So basically, I got out from behind the podium, walked up to the well, felt the first police officer coming up behind me, felt him, you know, kind of grab my wrist. And I made it very clear that like I was keeping my hands down by my side. As soon as I felt the police officer approaching, put him behind my back. And then as he grabbed my wrist, I told him like, hey, I'm going to go limp. Like, you know, I'm going to go to the ground. And so, you know, he guided me to the ground. Rest of the officers come in, make sure they secure me. They rolled me over and said, you know, are you going to walk out? I'm like, no, you're going to have to carry me out. Because again, peaceful civil disobedience. Like, I'm not here to fight you, but I'm also not going to comply. Like that's the whole point. This means enough to me that I am willing to break this law, right? Even if there's questions of if the law is even legal. Like, so we'll find out at my trial date. But yeah, it's very much like, you know, hey, like this is important. Like, and this is so important that I'm willing to do this in order for people to understand how important it is. So then they carried me out. As soon as we were out, I'm like, okay, you guys can put me down. I'll walk now. Like, again, I'm not trying to make your lives miserable. It's like at this point, the statement's been made. And yeah. So they walked me, searched me, walked me over to the jail cell. The jail is actually like right across the plaza from where the city council meets. So it's like a 30-second, 1-minute walk. Like it's pretty close. Got in, they processed me to go into a jail cell. And then the detention officials made it seem that like this would be a pretty quick like in and out, you know, you're gonna be out in like an hour or so. And they told my wife the same thing when she called. They're like, yeah, you know, he should be out in about like an hour or so. I was in my cell for I think 2 to 2.5 hours before they finally charged me with something. And then I eventually got out another like hour and a half after that. So I was in there for about 4 hours total. And I'm wondering if anyone from the city council made a call to the police station and said, hey, you need to like find something to stick on this guy to make an example out of him. Because I've heard from former city council members, and normally what happens is that they just take you out of the room and they give you a warning and then they send you on your way. So yeah, I'm very curious to know what the behind the scenes communication was that night.
Right. So what about your kids? What do your kids think of their dad purposefully, you know, messing with the man?
Well, they thought it was hilarious because my wife actually texted me like literally right before I was about to go on. She's like, oh, hey, you know, forgot you were at the meeting. Like, you know, how's it going? I'm like, well, I'm about to go on. So she told me later. She's like, yeah. So I turned the TV on. And she's like, you know, kids, come on. You know, your dad's about to speak. So basically I spoke. They left before the very end. And then she's like, you got to come back in. He's getting arrested. And so they came back and just started laughing. And so, yeah, because, you know, we're trying to raise our kids to have like a sense of right and wrong, right? Like to have a sense of empathy and to care for other people. And I'd like to think that they understand that like I'm not breaking the law for a small reason. Like I'm breaking the law because I feel like this is a very, very important issue, both locally as well as nationally. And it's something that people do need to be aware of and to be talking about and to be making plans for. Because, I mean, this administration has shown no signs of slowing down. Like they're trying to speed run Hitler's playbook. And I'm not okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the question. You talked about the fact in the meeting that this is a time-honored tradition of civil disobedience, and your description of what you were going through shows me that you knew exactly what you were doing in that. Where did you get that guidance in your own life to take on that kind of civil disobedience?
Well, so I'm a history and poli-sci major, and I love reading books. And a big inspiration for it was, the American Civil Rights Movement back in the 60s, where, you'd have sit-ins, you'd have peaceful protesters. And the point of a lot of those protests was to take up space and to show people, this means so much to me that I'm willing to force the police to arrest me. And my hope is that we can get things turned around, that enough people will recognize that before it starts escalating to the water cannons and dogs in the street, before it starts escalating to something like Kent State, before it starts escalating to the military potentially being called in or the formation of brown shirts, which we're already seeing reports of. Like that's, again, people need to understand, I'm not being hyperbolic here. We are following almost beat for beat the path that Germany took in Hitler's rise to power. it's not a joke. It's not over the top. It is what is happening right now.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think that what we all know as white guys here sitting around talking about this is it's also people of privilege who need to be doing this, mm-hmm. right? The four kids at Kent State, just the world cracked open. And still, mm-hmm. J. Edgar Hoover tried to malign all of them. But the two kids at Mississippi State, everybody forgot their names, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea that we can leave this on the shoulders, and I think you make so many beautiful points about that in your book about Sparkle Ponies. The idea that we can leave that on the shoulders of the people who are being oppressed is wrong. That
correct.
We have to step up because we are the ones who are least likely to get in trouble at the end of the day in this whole mess.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like we have the power and the privilege, and therefore it falls upon us to be the ones who act. And also, let's not get it twisted. Like the voting data shows Donald Trump is a white people problem. White people put Donald Trump in power. So we need to clean up our mess.
He is a white people problem. One other question. I mean, I don't want to hop on your book, except I loved your takedown of Ayn Rand. I just loved
thank you.
It, right? It incredible. Is Donald Trump Galt?
He's not smart enough to be Galt.
Or is Musk Galt?
No, he's not smart enough either to be Galt. I mean, if you look at, so Musk in particular, like he has this myth of being, this super business genius, tech overlord. And the media has played a large part in founding that myth. Because when you look at what he's actually done, he took $5 million from his dad, right? Who got his money from apartheid blood emeralds. So right away, there's a problem with the foundation, okay? And then he gets lucky because he can afford to invest in a bunch of different things. And the consistent story of Elon Musk from company to company to company is that he gets kicked out of those companies because he doesn't know what he's doing. But he does it after he's made enough money to go get another company. And a lot of his current wealth is tied up in Tesla, which is why I don't know if you guys have heard about it, but the Tesla takedown movement that's happening, basically people are protesting in front of Tesla dealerships across the United States and across the world. Because if we can get Tesla to fall, that topples the rest of his economic empire because he's borrowed against his Tesla shares. So Elon Musk is a dipshit. Like he's just flat out, like you can't see him on stage drugged out of his mind, throwing a, wielding a chainsaw around and not think anything other than like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? and the problem is that he is now de facto in charge of our federal government because they're letting his tech teams, who are also dipshits, into the treasury, into the Social Security system, you know, into the Department of Education, into the Department of Energy, which, may I remind people, controls our nuclear weapons. These two, they're con artists. And that actually is an American tale as old as America. The grifter, right, that comes through and manages to swindle everyone. I mean, Mark Twain wrote about that a lot, right? You know, that is a quintessentially American thing, is to be a very successful con man. Like, that's deep in the bones of our history. So yeah, these two have convinced the people around them that if they stick with Musk or Trump, they will end up better off, but that never ends up being the case.
So what do we do? If someone's listening and they're feeling, I mean, I don't think I've had a decent night's sleep. Mm-hmm. Definitely not since January 20th, but probably not since November 5th. And I want to know whose idea it was to have an election on Guy Fawkes Day. Somebody's going to have to get back to me on that. But what should people be doing? Should everyone be getting a nice takedown at their town council if the town council's not listening, or at their legislature? I mean, can everyone do civil disobedience? And when I was doing my big activist days, we were trying not to get arrested because we couldn't afford the court proceedings and the, you know, it's costly to get arrested. So what do we do?
Yeah. So that brings up a really good point. And it gets back to the whole power and privilege thing, right? So that's why people like me need to be leading the charge on this, because we are the ones who can afford to be arrested. Like, our elected Democratic officials need to be doing this because they can afford to get arrested, especially our senior ones. Like, you've made a ton of money, a lot of it through insider trading. Maybe use that for the betterment of the country, like set up a bail bond or a bail fund for people. And in terms of like what people can do individually, talk to the people around you, start setting up local networks, find people who are like-minded people, get together with each other, and then figure out, okay, what am I willing to do? What can't I afford to do? Because then now as a community, you figured out, okay, you know, here are the people who can afford to do direct action, right? And cause civil disobedience, get arrested. Here are the people who can't do that, but maybe they can be the ones in charge of calling elected officials or contacting other people, right? Or maybe these people don't really want to get arrested, but they're willing to fund a bail fund, right? They're willing to pay for legal fees. That's, again, come together as a community. And the more people you can get involved, the better, because I know it's trite to say, but there are more of us than there are of them. We just have to get together and show them that. And that has been the case historically. Fascism is a losing movement, because it inevitably fails and it makes people's lives worse. And then people get so fed up with it, they're like, no, we're not going to do this. So I would prefer to avoid all the steps in between where a lot of people die and just get straight to the part where we say, no, we don't do this. And then the fascism goes away for a while. So yeah, contact your local officials, your elected representatives, show up to your city council meetings. If you don't know how to meet people, showing up to your city council meetings is a good way to start, because generally the politically active people will be there and they'll be involved and they can tell you. And yeah, just, you know, help each other.
That fits in really well too with kind of the philosophy that we're going with this podcast of volunteerism, get out there and do things the secular saints do in their community, and self-care for those people that need that. Mm-hmm. Do you have any organizations personally that you really feel do a good job and should have our support in terms of volunteerism?
So one thing I did, because I had a lot of people asking me over the last couple of days, you know, hey, I'd like to buy your jersey or something, you know, to show support. And I tweeted or skeeted on Blue Sky that I don't need the money. If you want to support me, I would rather you donate to either Trans Lifeline or the Trevor Project, because those are two foundations that will help the people that are currently being oppressed. And it's very important that we recognize what the trans community is going through right now, because this administration is making every attempt it can to erase them from existence. And it falls upon us as human beings to say, no, we will not allow that. We are going to help them survive and we're going to help them thrive. So yeah, if you don't know anything else to do, Trans Lifeline, Trevor Project, if you have local LGBTQ groups, donate to them, because they'll know the best way to get assistance to those who need it.
That's great. That's wonderful. Hey, you know what? First of all, absolutely love that you turned down the New York Times, but you said yes to us.
She was rather ecstatic.
Then, thanks so much for like the two times in my life that I can remember really thinking, who's going to take the lead on this? You showed up. So well, thanks. I appreciate that. That's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, no, and like I said, it's like I'll never ask someone to do something I'm not willing to do myself. If I want to see my elected officials getting arrested on the floor of Congress, yeah, hey, I just showed you how to do it.
Make sure you tell them you're going limp.
Right?
Great tutorial.
Pick me up. It's awesome. Wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And I don't want to take up an incredible amount of your time, but I cannot thank you enough for joining us on the podcast. I think the designation, I know there was a question about the term sacred and sacred legions and saint and secular saint. And it kind of has connotations that I think both of us have challenges with. But to me, what you're doing is certainly serving people that I care about and showing the kind of empathy that I think needs to be in the world. And that's what saintliness is to me.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I know what Vonnegut was going for with that. And I agree with it. And that, like, you don't have to be overtly religious in order to help other people. Like, you don't have to believe in the idea of a God or a devil or a heaven or hell in order to help other people. Anyone can help other people. And I think that that was a big part of his writing, is that, you know, look out for each other, right? Like, it's just us at the end of the day. It's just human beings. Like, and we have to be able to see each other as human beings.
You know, one other thing you had in your book that I meant to mention that really struck with me for a long time was the story of the two soldiers who were told to kill each other. I mean, it's, when I think about it now, it's just so upsetting that, you know, they were following orders. And so even though they became friends in the story, they had to make those guns work.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that's the thing, like, that to me, that gets to like a really key part of human nature, is that, like, we cooperate with each other so well. Human beings are social creatures. Like, we want to be around each other. We want to help each other. We want to make each other's lives better. But when that is abused to do something like make a gun or go to war, well, then that, like, that's the end result. We end up killing each other. So we have to make the conscious decision to help each other and to realize when someone is trying to get to pit us against each other. Because if we can do that, then we can say, no, I won't fire the gun at the other person. We are the same. We're humans.
Make America alluring again.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh my God, that was so much fun.
I know, wasn't it? I love talking to him. I love the whole football talk. But did you hear that he lost his coaching job?
I did hear that. Just because he talked, was it because he spoke out at the board meeting? Is that why they canned him?
Well, that was certainly what his impression was. But of course, the school came back and said, oh, no. It was some of your Facebook postings or social media postings were problematic. So they've got their out.
You know, I went and followed him on Facebook this past week since we interviewed him. We did that interview about 10, 11 days ago. And it's a riot because he has not posted on Facebook since 2013.
And all of a sudden he's come back and been a force. And yeah, it is wonderful.
If you can in his Facebook post, they got to go back 12 years because he hasn't made a post on Facebook for 12 years. So pretty ridiculous. I am following him though, even if just in case he posts something someday.
Well, and the posts that he made were on Blue Sky, so maybe that's a little different too. I'm still trying to get used to. I haven't even started Blue Sky, but I need to.
Yeah, so yeah. I love Blue Sky, and it's the counter Twitter, right? So because Elon Musk bought and destroyed Twitter, which he did purely to, you know, twist minds and brains and thoughts of people, this whole thing was started to give people a place to have that same sort of presence. You know, the only thing I don't like about all of those social media that aren't Facebook, and I'm not plugging Facebook by any means, but Facebook gives you an opportunity to do like an angry emoji or a happy emoji or, you know, in addition to the thumbs up, you can do, oh, I love that. You know, important. Like, all you get is the heart emoji on Blue Sky. And there's times when I want like the middle finger emoji.
Yeah, there is that.
Some other thought process besides heart, you know, because it's hard to see a post about a bomb hitting a village and love it. Right.
Yeah, so, very true. And I mean, there's the downside too, that they haven't had as long to develop their stuff, because I'm sure Facebook was clunky as hell when it first started too, but
it was all just that thumbs up in the beginning. Yeah. Well, it's clunky as hell now. The only good thing about it is that you've sold your identity to Mark Zuckerberg. And in exchange for that, you get to know what's happening to that kid you went to high school with. And it's really hard to give that up, I think, after a while.
I know for Sacred Legions, trying to get the word out, because to me, this is an important thing that we're doing. The idea of interviewing people who are secular saints, number one, is fantastic to me. The giving you good stories. I am so tired of news being doom, gloom, which clearly it could be right now. I want to hear about people that are inspiring and doing good things. And I want to encourage listeners to find their bliss in volunteerism and self-care as well.
Yeah. I was talking to my grandchildren about this yesterday, about being nice. You know, they said, well, you're nice. And I said, well, thank you. But I'm nice because I'm selfish, because it feels good to be nice. It's fun to be nice. It's nice to be nice, right? And it's nice to make someone else's life a little easier. And I can't help but imagine that there are people either A, that don't know that, or B, that don't have fun doing it. Like, wouldn't that suck if you do? One of the things I used to do all the time when the kids were little, because A, it was cheap, and B, it was possible, was I used to pay for the car behind me at the toll booth.
Yeah.
Now, in those days, it was 25 cents or 50 cents to go through the toll booth. So it wasn't, you know, when we were broke, it was a nice thing you could do that didn't cost you a lot. Oh, my God, the kids would turn around as fast as they could and giggle at the person who was trying to pay and couldn't, you know, and I just feel bad for someone who isn't having that kind of joy in their life.
So it's almost like a practical joke against the car behind you. Your kids are getting a kick out of it, but really it's also a very kind thing. And I feel the same way. I've been the beneficiary of driving through a coffee shop and someone will pay for my coffee. And it's like, that's so kind of them. And I never have that thought in my own head to do it myself. And it's kind of a shame that I don't. And that's something that I can work on from a volunteerism standpoint.
Yeah, it would be fun. I'm going to try it this week. I have never done that either. I'm going to do it this week. Say, here's $5. Pay $5 of that person's bill. So Max, when you called me and said you wanted to do Sacred Legions, of course, we're both ginormous Kurt Vonnegut fans, which is the reason we know each other. Well, the real reason we know each other is because my right. son moved to Indianapolis and then I started like stalking the town like a creepy old lady. But then I wandered into the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library and you were given a tour. My love of Kurt Vonnegut.
I was giving you a tour.
Yeah. And my love of
And your daughter.
Kurt Vonnegut brought me there and your love of Kurt Vonnegut made you a docent, whatever that word is, to guide people through Kurt's life. But what made you go that leap from, I really love the guy, to I can take his philosophy. He's a great philosopher and implement it in other people's lives. I mean, even if we've only affected the people's lives who got to express themselves so far on the show, you know, it's nice to be Diane Nyland, Diane Davis, you know, Salim, all those folks. It's nice to be asked, why did you do something so important? You know, so where did the idea
come from? Yeah, no kidding. And I would like to be able to say that I had this brilliant idea to bring joy and happiness into the world. It really didn't happen like that. And in fact, there's some downside to it. Like initially, I was probably like everybody else. There's this salacious part of you that goes, I want to tell these stories about very bad people. I even listened to a podcast called Behind the Bastards that does that very thing. They look at people historically and they give you a full background on just how bad they were. And it's wonderful listening. I listen to many of the episodes and I love listening to it, but it is also salacious. And my original idea was to do some of that background on people that, like from my extremely religious upbringing, there were a lot of people I was introduced to who easily could be identified as bastards that I could easily talk about for, you know, several episodes of a podcast. That was like the original seed in my brain. But then I don't know. There's this trigger that comes up of there's just so much of that nonsense in the world. We could talk about all of the bad people, all the bad things. There really isn't enough discussion of people who are doing good things. And more than that, there's not enough to promote goodness in the world the way that it should be. I wish I could remember the quote. I know Christina used it in the very first podcast we did about if secular saints could organize, or if good people, if angels could organize in the way that the mafia did, I think it was, what a great world this would be. And I think that's kind of where I came to this from.
So it's the angel mafia you're forming. Well, I got one thing to say about a podcast about bastards. If you don't want to end up in a podcast about bastards, don't be a bastard, period. But, you know, there's this, I'm entitled to do whatever kind of rotten thing I want to do, and nobody can criticize me for it. And I think that's completely off limits, which is another thing I really love about the people we've interviewed is they call things what they are. You know, they speak the truth and they don't waver from it. But I also think that I remember when you came to me and you were talking about the beginning, you know, this beginning germination. And I do remember now that you mentioned it, the grappling with your religious, I had the same problem, absolute. It reminds me of that famous line from A Lion in Winter, "So the royal corkscrew finds me twisted." Like I couldn't, it took me decades to untwist from the corkscrew I was turned into by religion. And I'm so grateful that I don't have one. That said, I'm grateful for people I know, like Matthew Best and others, as a reverend, a Lutheran minister I know, who are the embodiment as much as they can be of what they believe Christ asked people to be. And I know Muslims like that. My dear friend Stacy, who's she works with the homeless tirelessly. She's in Ramadan right now. And when I was, I invited her for dinner and I said, you know, I'd like to break one of your fasts with you for Ramadan. And I was looking at the details so that I could do it properly. And it said that, you know, you spend the day eliminating your sin from your life. That's why you fast all day in Ramadan. And I thought, God, what's Stacy got to get rid of? She is one of the angels that belongs in the mafia, you know? So while I'm so grateful to have rejected religion, I do know that it's a wonderful motivating force for some people who clue into the message, which is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, right? Which is in absolutely every religion, Hindu, Buddhism, everything, Hinduism. But in so far, in the process of this podcast, we have touched on some pretty deep topics, right? Social, the judicial system, refugees, homelessness, poverty. And then now, I mean, with Chris Cluey, how many of us are willing to just stand up today? I mean, can Chris Cluey be that kind of an inspiration?
Right. And that's the hope with all the people that we interview that we can do that. And I want to come back to your point about the religious trauma, because I would certainly consider myself a kind of a victim of religious trauma. But in no way, and you made the point very, very well, in no way do I have any judgment about people who have religious beliefs. Many people in my family are still very religious. My concerns are purely, how are you treating other human beings? What can you do to make other people's lives better? And if you are doing that, be it through your religion or without your religion, either one, I'm happy with that. And I feel that that is an example of Kurt Vonnegut in the first place. He was avowedly, from generations back, a secular humanist. His family were all secular humanists from the time that they came over from Germany. But there was nobody that extolled the virtues of the Sermon on the Mount more than Kurt Vonnegut. That was like a touchstone of his that he talked about all the time. And you can't divorce the Sermon on the Mount from religion. So in no way do I have anything negative to say about religion. I have negative things to say about people that don't practice humane treatment of other people.
So have you, I know that you've had the Bible beaten into you, as have I. a little bit. Have you read the Sermon on the Mount as recorded in each of the four Gospels?
Oh my gosh. I'm sure that I have. And it's interesting that you, I mean, that's almost traumatizing, the four Gospels. Because they are, they're so different. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, they are.
I don't know that I ever did, but now that you've issued that challenge, and I would probably have to go online to find a copy of the Bible. I don't know that I've got a copy of the Bible in my house anymore.
Yeah.
Well, sounds like a good challenge.
I bring it up is because three of them are very similar. Three of the Beatitudes are almost identical, like blessed are the poor of heart or whatever. No, not poor of heart. Blessed are the, you know, whatever, the meek. But when you get to Luke, who, by the way, was, if you want to use this term, a doctor, physician, if of course, this is pre-Dark Ages, so they probably did do some helpful things. In the Dark Ages, they just slapped you with leeches and sent you home. But Luke's is threatening. You better do this. Or, I mean, it's Beatitudes with if they were given to you by an angry biker crowd. Not the bikers can't be lovely, but, you know, the ones waiting for you outside the bar because you said hi to their girlfriend. It's threatening. Like, you better be this or you're going to get a smoke kicking. So it's just fascinating. And, you know, I only read the Bible so closely because I'm writing the autobiography of Jesus Christ, and I don't think I'll ever get it done. But of course, there's no less humble title for an author to use than the autobiography of Jesus Christ. Anyway, I just think it's interesting that one of those gospels made it through the second century AD or CE, however you want to refer to it, with such a bitch slapping in it.
Yeah, well, that's part of the issue I think I had with my upbringing is you look at it from that dogmatic standpoint of every single word is exactly what it's supposed to be from the from the mouth of God. And it just never worked for me because you start looking at little contradictions and you go, wait a minute, I can't even. Anyway, I didn't mean to.
Do as I say, not as I do. The thing that bugs me about religion, and it's any religion that subjugates women, the concept that a young woman can use her body in any way that makes her less valuable, is so absolutely. I've never struck another human being in my life, but it makes me so. I feel this swelling of anger that someone could tell a young woman, me when I was young, or any woman, that any natural desire makes you less than. It's just disgusting to me. And it's such a control mechanism. And so many religions try to control women. And so therefore.
and I would also say, this is kind of an offshoot of that, but clarification too. Yes, religion tends to promote that in people who are powerful. Like, they use religion as a tool to separate and undermine because it increases their power. It has nothing to do with the religion in the first place. That's not what the religion was designed for. That's not what the beliefs were designed for. It is what those powerful people who want to remain powerful and want to diminish the power of anybody else interpret out of a religion for their benefit. It has nothing to do with the religion itself, in my view.
Yeah. Well, it's all government, right? It's either a government of the people, by the people, which is something that we were talking to Chris about maybe losing if we're not careful, or if we haven't already lost it. And then it's also a government ordained by God, which has been negotiated into existence by man. So this, when I look at Donald Trump speaking, that's all he's trying to do. It's the oldest trope in the book. There's nothing new to that guy. There's absolutely nothing new to Donald Trump. He's the most ordinary, uncomplex two-dimensional character in United States history, in my opinion. He's just a bad facsimile of bad guys. And what he's trying to do is he's working it up. I mean, even when, oh, the news was that he didn't name J.D. Vance as his successor. No, because he wants it to be Don Jr. Like, nobody's paying attention. And so I just think if people don't understand that he's just such a, he's caveman, not to insult cavemen, seafood, eat food, get full, go to sleep, have sex, seafood, eat food, get full, go to sleep, have sex. And, you know, all of it with his head on a rock that you can barely tell the difference between the two. And he's just a guttural, basic. And I think for a lot of his people, a lot of his charm and his charisma, and I'm making air quotes, but he is charismatic, is the fact that he makes people feel better because he's actually goddamn dumber than they are. And it's a shame that people can't see that this unworthy pseudo list is garbage.
Yeah, and I've been pretty heavily influenced. I read a book on trauma recently, and that whole idea of just how trauma forms us. And as much of a challenge as I have with a lot of the people that we have in power, I do have this deep-seated understanding of it, they didn't get there without trauma of their own. And it's shameful that trauma then breeds trauma on everybody else. And I absolutely can't forgive that part of it. But I'm sympathetic to the fact that trauma, unfortunately, creates problems for a lot of things.
You know, when I read Mary Trump's book about him as a young man, you know, about how awful his father was to him and everything, I saw my own father, which was unique. You know, you wouldn't expect that. My father's certainly not born to a wealth. He was born in poverty. His father was a Boston policeman, a brutal Boston policeman. I see that guy's billy club in handcuffs and shudder at what they've experienced in his hands, right? But when I read about Trump as a kid, I felt so bad for him. It just felt so bad. You know, his life was really terrible. He was abandoned. His mother got sick for a year and his father didn't hire anyone to take care of him. So as this little kid's toddling around and his older sister, who's seven, is getting him his needs. And it's a horrible story. And if he would just go away and fade into the distance and stop being harmful, I'd feel sorry for him. I'd carry all that sympathy forward to today for him. But he won't go away and let me care about him that way. He insists on causing all this harm and then surrounding himself with more. And you know, there's a reason for why he's the way he is, but there's no excuse for it. So,
right.
Ugh, yeah, you got to move on. And so
we've gone off on a...
No, I was just going to say, I'm really grateful that you've brought up this other way of looking at the world, right? Brought up this other way of looking at the world. We're in a world with people like him. We're in a world with people like Elon Musk. And you're reminding us that we're also in a world with people like Chris Chloe.
And that truly is what this is all about. I do want to promote those people. And I want to promote that in the people that listen to us. If you're listening to Sacred Legions, I'm going to believe that it's because you are good, decent, secular saints yourself, and that you want to see good and do good in the world. And that's important. And so to do a little bit of promotion here, we've got this podcast going, but the website that we've got, sacredlegions.org, I encourage you to go visit that website. I also would love, I keep looking for messages to come from the website, and I haven't seen any yet, but I know they're going to come at some point, of organizations that you recommend for people that want to volunteer and do better. Organizations that provide self-care for maybe for you and for other people, or just comments about the podcast, what you liked, what you would like to hear in the future. I would love to hear all those things. And if you go to the website, the ability to be able to communicate with us is right there on the homepage.
But Max, some people don't like writing on a website. So what's your direct email address? Max@sacredlegions.org?
It is, as a matter of fact. So yeah, okay. If you go,
so people can write directly to Max. If you're one of those people who's not going to leave message on a website, we get it. Write directly to Max, max@sacredlegions.org. The other thing to send Max is ideas for the show. If you know a secular saint and you think the rest of the world needs to know who they are, send us some information about them. Tell us who that is. Say why they're a secular saint in your world. You may have noticed that many of the people we've talked to so far, you didn't know about before. And that's not a surprise. I mean, while Diane Davis is an amazing human being and what she did for people getting off planes at 9/11 who couldn't go home was an amazing thing. But 99% of people don't know her. She's not a household name. So you may know a secular saint who likewise isn't a household name. And you should send that information to Max as well.
Yeah, because at the moment, we're getting a lot of these from other people. I'm going to kind of name drop a little bit here. I was out at lunch this week with a friend who just happens to be the keyboardist for the band, the Lumineers. And he was giving me all these suggestions about, you should talk to this person, you should talk to that person. And believe you me, I want to talk to all of those people that were recommended because they're fantastic. And hopefully I'll be able to tell you those names as they come up and I'll go, this is the person that we got on the show because of Stealth Wolfgang of the Lumineers. So I'll give that shout out to Stealth. Thank you, Stealth. I won't tell you, tell anybody who you recommended to us, but know that I appreciate the recommendations.
So Max, until next time.
Until next time. I want to thank everyone for listening. I really love what we've been able to do in these episodes, and I look forward to going ahead for many, many years to come. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions LLC. It is hosted by Max Scholar and Pat LaMarche. It's produced by Pat LaMarche. It's recorded and edited by Max Scholar. Original music comes to us from the talented Jamie Callan. For more Sacred Legions episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on one of your favorite podcast services. If you like what we're doing here and want to show some support, visit our shop at www.sacredlegions.com and purchase some of our merchandise offerings or chip in a few bucks to buy us a cup of coffee. If you happen to be like my Ameri-British children, you can even make it a cup of tea. Cheerio.